guest artist, visiting artist in ceramics.
Ring the bell.
Anyway, I'm going to talk about wood firing. It's something I'm very interested in. I've been doing wood firing or firing with wood for about 12 years, firing pottery. Sorry, I put on the slide. And what does that mean? It's using wood as a fuel for firing or heating up pottery. Very, very old. The making of pottery is one of the oldest crafts of man, thousands of years old. And for several thousands of years, it's hard to determine how long they've been using wood as a means of bonfire or a controlled fire, with using wood to make pottery. And in this century, it's become almost a lost art and sort of rediscovered in contemporary times. In just the past 10 years or so in the United States, there's been kind of a rediscovery of using wood as a fuel to fire pottery. Gas and oil and coal and electricity, those fuels have replaced wood, and it's kind of a novelty that's kind of re-emerging in contemporary ceramics. I want to show a few slides here of tamba pots that are about 16th century Japanese jars that give a good display of what wood firing does. These are unglazed pots, and they're put in a big chamber. The kiln is fired with wood, and as the ash from the wood deposits on the pieces, it collects on the shoulders, and when that gets hot enough, the ash turns into glass and becomes glazed. So there's this interest in contemporary ceramics to kind of try to reproduce this kind of very organic, very natural look. Some of the very first glazes ever discovered were wood ash glazes, that because they were firing kilns with wood, they were starting to get buildup of wood ash that turned into glaze. And then they figured that out, and they started to intentionally apply concoctions of wood ash from the fire and apply glazes intentionally. But you need to have a pretty extreme high temperature to make this wood ash melt and form glass. It's a temperature exceeding 2300 degrees Fahrenheit, or close to 1300 degrees centigrade. So it can't happen in just a bonfire situation. You have to build a very specialized kiln chamber and very carefully controlled firing to achieve these high temperatures. Anyway, these are examples of unglazed wood-fired pots. The wood ash has created all of this glass and decoration that you see. These pots are very casual forms. These are made by farmers. They weren't meant to be perfect symmetrical pots. And a lot of them are like this one, very beautiful in their asymmetry. And here you can see a very dramatic effect of the wood ash collecting and forming a very beautiful surface here. Also, the thing about kind of backtracking, I guess pottery can't become pottery, or it doesn't become permanent until it faces the fire. And I've been thinking, a topic that could be discussed of the whole relationship of pottery and making of pottery as it might relate to our lives in some way. The Bible says that we were made from clay. NASA has recently discovered that clay is probably the most primitive form of life. And they were able to detect that clay, when it's worked and moved around, actually gives off energy. And when it dries, it gives off energy. Anytime you shape it or move it, add water, it gives off some sort of measurable energy. And they determined that it was capable of duplicating information. Very, very primitive sort of signs of what we might determine as a life form. And the rocks of these mountains out here disintegrate and become clay, which is the most primitive form of life. So maybe in our connectedness to the environment, the mountains are truly indeed alive, and clay, the most abundant material on the surface of Earth, perhaps is the most primitive form of life. Taking this material, this most abundant, cheap, this dirt, the mud of the earth, the mud that collects on our shoes, and forming this into a meaningful object, a vessel, has a lot of symbolism, that would maybe perhaps could be related to us as human beings, as we are sort of vessels, and could go on and on about the philosophical meaning of it. I'm interested in pottery for many different reasons. Anyway, this is mostly about kilns and the firing and what happens to clay when it is heated up and transforms into a durable material. The Oriental people have been long been given credit for high technology in the making of pottery, advanced technology in making pottery. About the first century BC, they were capable of firing to stoneware temperatures, high temperatures, that's about 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit. And none of the rest of the world knew how that was done. They could fire to lower temperatures, but this extreme high temperature firing was a secret, a very carefully guarded secret. Some of these kilns, this is a very old historic kiln in Japan, it's become a museum piece. And they're beautiful in themselves almost as fossils, because the early kilns were kind of dug into a bank of clay, and as the fire going through this tunnel of clay, it fired the kiln shell, which became a durable sort of vessel in itself. And you see these fossils, kiln fossils in the countryside. Some of the largest wood burning kilns are in Japan, still operable. And this one is a climbing chamber kiln. It's called a Noriboragama, which means that it's a climbing chamber kiln. It's this first little bump at the bottom is where the wood would initially be stoned or fed, and fire would travel through these chambers. Maybe I've got some slides that will better show that. And this one is another view of these separate little chambers, and the flames, wood produces a very, very long flame, maybe 50 feet long perhaps. A little piece of wood could burn a long flame, and this flame would travel through these chambers. Maybe I could, this next slide kind of shows a little better drawing of how this might work. The bottom is the firebox area, and then the flames would travel through these chambers and passageways. If you can see kind of at the base of each chamber, there's kind of an opening for the flames to continue through. I'm interested in wood as a fuel for many different reasons. That it's a non-fossil fuel, for one thing, and I think that in many ways it's better than gas or coal or other fossil-bearing fuels. If you have a large enough kiln, it is a very efficient fuel, probably the most efficient fuel. To give you an example, say in this kind of a kiln, this climbing chamber kiln, it may take 16 hours for the first chamber to reach temperature, but the flames are exiting out through the other chambers as it goes up and out the kiln, and those chambers only take about 4 hours to fire temperature, so it captures and utilizes the exhaust heat, which isn't done so much in other kinds of kilns with different kinds of fuel. So if you have a big enough kiln, the wood firing is actually the most efficient fuel you can use. A variety of other kilns too, I just wanted to run through. This is sort of a camouflaged kiln. You can make it out in the bottom right hand corner, is sort of the doorway. It's kind of an abandoned kiln at the moment in Tunisia. And above where I'm standing is the top chimney of the kiln. It's a huge updraft kiln, and it may be photographed from the inside. Kind of give you an idea of the volume of this kiln. It's a big, huge dome, beehive shape. And they would stack the pots in with no kiln shelves, one on top of another. These are all unglazed, so they're not going to fuse together. So they can just be fired. They said that it took about 7 days for them to fire to temperature, about 1600 degrees Fahrenheit. using palm fronds. In Indonesia, they didn't have a lot of wood, so they were using palm fronds for fuel. It's interesting to see different parts of the world what they actually use for fuel. I've seen tires being used in Israel. Film I saw from there, burning tires. In Libya, we saw burning date pits for fuel, a dump truck full of date pits, and they would shovel that in for fuel. This is a drawing, a famous drawing of a 16th century updraft kiln. Maybe you can see what's going on here. It's a freestanding brick kiln. There's a flame that these people are tending in the bottom of the kiln, and it goes up through the floor and out the top. You see little wisps of smoke going out the top. And this story about this kiln was how carefully it needs to be managed and maintained to get temperature. And at one time, this potter, it's a famous pottery book, Pickle Picasso or some Palladio or some 16th century potter, not Palladio, the architect. Burning the fence down around the studio to finish off the firing. This is a beautiful bottle-shaped kiln. It's a wood-burning kiln. It's in an updraft floor. There are four fireboxes around the base, the perimeter, and the flames would circulate and go up and out the top. This kind of kiln is capable of an oxidation firing, which was necessary for use of lead glazes that were used throughout Europe. Low temperature lead glazes. It has an upper chamber for a bisque firing.
Where was that, Jerry?
What's that?
Where was that last one?
That was in England. It was at the Winchcombe Pottery. One more point about this one. It has these metal bands around it, and as the firing progresses, these had to be loosened up to accommodate for the expansion of the kiln, and then as it cooled down, they had to tighten the bands back up to hold the kiln together. It's no longer in use, you know, you can kind of tell it's in disrepair, but these kind of kilns were very common in the 1800s, up until the 1800s. Another kiln that was kind of had been restored and was a working kiln, this was in the south of Paris, in France. They were trying to duplicate, or they were trying to restore homes, and they had to simulate or duplicate the tile work that was originally wood-fired, which this gives a better look that these tiles being kind of discolored comes from the wood-firing process. And the Italian tiles are usually produced with hydroelectricity, and they're oxidized firing. All the tiles are perfectly clean burned, and you don't get this irregularity. So wood-firing at lower temperatures can provide a beautiful warmth and irregular coloring to the clay because of the oxidation and reduction atmosphere that can alternate throughout the firing. Here's another bottle-shaped kiln. These are beautiful structures in themselves. This one you can see it's from a picture I got. It's up in Massachusetts at a kind of a centuries farm where they try to reproduce how it was 100 years ago. And most all the crockery that was made was fired in kilns such as this. And this has a steel band that kind of holds the shape together. But it's kind of like follows the shape of a candle flame teardrop shape. So it kind of harbors most efficiently the shape of the flame, this updraft shape. A couple new kilns or contemporary kilns. Gas is by far probably the most abundant use fuel for kilns now, and most of the kilns in operation, either industrial kilns or institutions, are gas fired. This is where I'm at. This is a long tunnel kiln too for production. Factories, they often go with a long tunnel kiln. This is again a Figio factory, and I showed some slides last week on Figio. Their whole factory had train tracks that went through it, and all the wear was moved about on these little cars, railroad cars. And we're looking in the door of this kiln. It's called a tunnel kiln, where the center of the kiln is where you see that kind of orange color is in the middle. This whole kiln is about 100 feet long, And these cars are slowly pushed into the hot spot, so they slowly warm up as the cars move towards that. They reach the temperature, and then they slowly advance beyond that and cool down. So it's a continuous kiln. It's never shut down. It's constantly hot. The most advanced or most recent development in kilns is the electric kiln. Here's a few at a convention we do some electric kilns, which have enabled pottery to be everywhere. People can have an electric kiln in their basement or garage. And so now there are more potters today than ever before in the history of man. Everybody can be a potter, be a weekend potter because of an electric kiln. But back to wood kilns, and that's kind of what I want to talk mostly about. Wood firing. Here's a dramatic photograph from a kiln we saw in Labourd, France, which is a pottery town, about 60 potters, who most all of them use wood firing techniques. Real dramatic. It's a huge kiln, and they're not concerned about pollution so much and exhaust. I'm more interested in efficiency and a clean burning kiln. This kiln, this kind of a kiln, is not that concerned with unburned fuel. And actually, the smoke from burned wood is not nearly as toxic or dangerous to the environment as burning fossil fuels. And here's the bottom end. This is kind of built on an upward slope in the bottom end where they're actually feeding in the fuel. A few more slides might help better explain what's going on here. Another shot from a magazine article of that same kiln. We're actually looking at the top end of the kiln. This is actually the chimney. These vent holes are where the flames exit out the chamber. I'll just run through a few of these. This is a smaller, what's called an Onagawa kiln. It's kind of shape of a watermelon or a football shape, which tried to contain the shape of a flame. Again, that candle wick or candle flame shape sort of kind of contain that shape. So it has a large hump. And these kilns kind of are an upward slope. The flames kind of, fire wants to move up, heat wants to travel upward. So these kilns kind of are built on an incline. You're kind of looking at the chimney and the exhaust, which with all that fire is not really that severe at all. This woman, Janet Stedman, was an English potter working there at this pottery town, and she, let me show her kiln, was kind of what we might call a climbing chamber kiln. In this slide, I wanted to point out these. And on the right-hand side, there are these little white, let's see if I can't quite point that out. These little white shapes right there are called saggers. And with firing with wood, those first slides I showed, if you allow the ash to land on your pots, it will build up this real rough, irregular, oozy, dripping surface. Throughout history, almost all the pottery has been fired in wood-burning kilns, and they certainly haven't all been this kind of crude surface. But if you put your pots inside of a container, these are little clay box shapes, you can get the heat from the wood firing and protect your ware from the ash buildup. So not everything has to be this oozy, kind of drippy, glazed surface. Has to have that. This is the back side of that, and you can kind of see the bottom hump there is the firebox. The flames would travel up through each chamber. When you have several chambers there, again, you can really economize on the heat because the heat is exhausting through these various chambers. This is some look of some of her pots. And here are some that were unprotected. The wood ashes has landed on there and very beautifully decorated the shoulder and the top and the handles. So these were unglazed prior to the firing. In contrast to that sort of firing, here was a gentleman in the same pottery town again that was firing very economically and very short. It's a 4-hour firing to cone 10, which if any of you are potters that know it, cone 10 is pretty high temperature. Usually take 10 or 12 hours or longer. Cone 10 in 4 hours is very, very quick. And he had a heat collector on his chimney which recycled hot air and put it back into the primary air, that air, the initial air that it was going into burn with the wood, and so it burned very, very efficiently. Outside of the studio, we had one of these, what I mentioned before, an Onagama kiln, which is kind of a in construction here. Stair-stepped, and the ware would be stacked on each of these kind of steps within that kind of a football-shaped construction. Now these kind of firings, often these potters are firing for days on end. Some people brag about firing for 2 or 3 weeks on end, and the long, long firings. I'm not so interested in the long, lengthy firings as I am as in the economizing of using wood as a fuel. Here's kind of a long tunnel-shaped kiln. You can see the bottom, the right is the opening, and the chimney is in the upper left-hand corner. It's about 40 feet long. When this gentleman would fire in about 5 days, he would be firing to reach temperature. 5 days, I just can't imagine that long of a firing. Look closer view. Here kind of shows the firebox arrangement where like a kiln I showed earlier from the same town. It's maybe kind of confusing, but the air comes through the bottom hole up through this kind of checkered floor where the wood is kind of put up above on the grates. So the air comes beneath the wood and up through and into the chamber. Along the crown of this, the arch, there were these little doors that they could drop wood in beside the pots and then heat the rear of the kiln up and even the temperature out. So occasionally throughout the firing they would open these little doors and drop extra fuel in. Another similar kiln, this was in St. Cloud, Minnesota at St. John's University. Richard Bresnahan had built this 5-chamber kiln, huge capacity. It was about a 500 cubic foot capacity kiln. And he said he built it for $500. He used all recycled materials, things that were local materials. This is a wood kiln at University of Iowa, kind of where I began wood firing, not in this particular kiln. There used to be a double chamber castable kiln in this, at this same site. These are American kilns now that is kind of this recent trend in people trying to fire with wood as an alternative fuel. Here's one I saw at Peters Valley in Layton, New Jersey, that is an art center. This one was built by a Japanese man, Katsu Sakazumi, and he was paid by the Japanese government to come to the United States and help build this kiln, because this was in 1983, and there were just a handful of these kinds of kilns in the United States at that time, only 7 years ago. And it was kind of a friendly gesture from Japan to a sharing of ideas. This is a very long kind of sloping upward. This is called an Onagama kiln. It's halfway buried in the earth. Kind of a side view of it. So that kind of hump shape is the chamber for the ware. And that tube up above is just kind of the chimney. This is a very nice upward slope for the flame to collect the heat and yet still let the flame travel up and out of the chamber. Here's a picture of it being fired. You see this dramatic flame coming out of the chimney. They had been firing for 11 days. When I was there, they were opening the kiln. They had burned 8 cords of wood. And their pots were heavily covered with wood ash and glaze from that long, lengthy firing. And that's quite an extreme to the kind of firing that I'm interested in. Here's another one. This is at Gatlinburg, Tennessee. a small little Anagama kiln, which Anagama again meaning buried in the earth, halfway buried in the earth. And the earth is one of the best insulators that you can have. So if your kiln is submerged or covered by the earth, it's a good insulation. See the chimney in the upper left-hand corner. A few comments about kiln construction is some of these kilns, the bricks are very, very heavy bricks, and you're dealing with tons and tons of bricks and weight. To build an enclosure, you have to have some sort of an arched form or some sort of a closed form. So here are two different arched forms. The one on the left is a sprung arch, which has kind of an arch shape, but the buttressing comes from the steel that's holding it in that tie rod to hold that kind of half curved shape up in the air. Those bricks on that probably weigh over a ton just for the roof of that chamber. The one on the right is called catenary arch, which is a parabolic curve, which is self-supporting, sort of like the Gothic cathedrals. It doesn't require the steel and framework buttressing that the one on the left requires. So if you're building kilns, you kind of figure out what you have available and materials, your skills at construction, lots of different possibilities. I was at Jugtown in North Carolina and visited the Ben Owens pottery, and they fire this kiln about every 10 days. It's called a groundhog kiln, it's a wood-burning kiln. It's maybe in their third or fourth generation of potters in this family continuously working here making pottery. Here this extremely dramatic flames coming out of the chimney. These two gentlemen here were the firers. They came by every week and fired the kiln. They didn't make pottery, they just stoked the wood. Here's kind of at the fire mouth. You see they're putting these huge boards in. And the boards were even soaked in motor oil, which made it very rapid firing, but it was extremely smoky and polluting. This was just after they stoked it up and just belching smoke. Very dramatic. Something I could never get away with at the University of Florida, right? University. And this is sort of, there's been all this talk about Japanese kilns and Anagama kilns, and there have been wood firing traditions going on. This is American tradition. In other parts of the world, wood firing has kept up and maintained their tradition. Some more kind of kilns from this area, Seagrove area, where all these folk potters continue to fire with wood. One thing about wood, it usually takes a pile of wood about the size of the kiln, the chamber of the kiln, to fire off the kiln. If you can imagine a pile of wood, when you burn it, a brush pile or a bonfire, there's a lot of heat involved, and the brush pile burns very, very rapidly, and that heat is just wasted. But taking that same pile of brush and burning it at a more efficient rate, and being able to capture that heat, is kind of what a kiln does, and that's how you fire a kiln with wood. It's just a matter of having a container that collects the heat, and it doesn't take as much wood as some people might imagine if you're very efficient and stoke the wood at a consistent rate. Pine, a fast burning wood, burns faster, so the faster you can burn that pile of wood up, the faster the kiln will advance. You can burn large, heavy pieces of logs, it burns slower, and it will take longer to reach temperature. This is a picture of David Shaner's kiln. It's in Big Fork, Montana, and he made his own bricks. And that's a possibility or an option. He said, however, he would never do it again. It was just too much work, too much labor to take the clay and press it into these brick shapes and then build a kiln. So he would recommend purchasing new bricks or finding a source of used fire brick. The two-chamber
pretty large kiln. He got an NEA grant and that helped pay for the construction of this kiln. Not such a good slide. This is a wood kiln in Des Moines, Iowa at the Living History Farms, and it's about a 200 cubic foot wood bar and salt kiln. Here's kind of a drawing, if it makes any sense at all. The kind of a cutaway view of the kiln we were to that last slide kind of showed in front of the doorway, which is on the right-hand side of this drawing. The ware being stacked then inside the chamber, and then a massive chimney, which usually is needed for or necessary for a wood kiln, is to be able to suck the, create a draft through the chamber and be able to pull that flame and the smoke up and out. Other kinds of fuels don't have as much exhaust as a wood kiln would have. There's some of the wear from that, or that kiln. I mean, he's trying to simulate or duplicate early American salt glaze wear. Salt glazing is a process where you, at the top end of your firing, when you reach maturity temperature, you introduce salt, sodium chloride, and it instantly volatilizes in the chamber, and the sodium then attacks the clay body, melting or acting as a flux, and melts the silica that's present in the clay and forms a glass coating. And, that was a discovery back in about the 16th century or so, a fairly recent discovery in the making of pottery, which enabled a once-fire glazing effect. This, all this gray color on the outside that shine was not applied. It was a result of the firing. My beginnings in wood firing began at the University of Iowa about 1978. This is a picture from my very first wood firing. And this was a two-chambered castable kiln, which we made wooden molds and forms and poured in a mixture of fire clay and sawdust and cement, and built the kiln by ramming, not using bricks, but by casting the walls and the arch, the whole structure. We had a nice little door on the firebox, and you open that up and put wood in. And I went to graduate school at Wichita State University in 1978-79, and constructed two wood-burning kilns there and did most of my master's thesis work on wood firing there. I was firing to cone 10 hours usually. Built a 40 cubic foot kiln and a 100 cubic foot kiln, and was able to fire them in very efficiently in a relatively short period of time. 10 hours is a pretty short firing compared to some people who take several days to fire their kilns. Then as a process, I had great wood. It was from a pellet company, and they had these little 1 by 1 inch by 4 foot long sticks, sort of like big matchsticks, and I could just put them in one at a time, and it burned very, very quickly. I didn't have to split any wood at all. It was beautiful, very, very little work, really. However, it was very hot. I remember firing, and one summer when it was 110 degrees every day, and it was 100 degrees at midnight. Here I was staying by this hot box trying to fire this kiln. Another experience from graduate school, I built these two kilns here, and we were firing them simultaneously. And my friend there had to go out for dinner or something with his wife, and he left for a few hours, and I was trying to fire both of these kilns at the same time. And if you have ever been around a wood kiln, it's something requires a lot of concentration, and I was actually literally running between these two kilns to keep them operating. There's another view from that. This one in the foreground was a big kiln. It had two separate stoking fireboxes. It's actually, at the time, I kind of designed it out of an idea that I had to try to contain the flame within the chamber, so the flames go under it. Tunnels to the back side of the chamber and enter on the back side of the chamber and circulate through the chamber. And later on I was told it was called a Phoenix design. Anyway, it fired very, very efficiently, even temperatures top to bottom, and big chamber that I can easily carve myself in about 10 hours, going 10 or 11. With wood carving, it takes a lot of effort, it takes a lot of, there's a lot of subtleties to maintain, and here in this picture I'm trying to make a point of the coals. The coals actually give off the heat. You have initial burning of the wood where the gases escape and burn, but the real heat comes from the coals that drop down into the bottom of the firebox in the ash pit area, and you want to maintain a constant bed of coals, and that's where the real heat comes from.
Does the flame comes off of the fire, is that, do those gases circulate through your kiln?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any smoke coloration then?
Yeah, there's on the pots themselves, they have a lot of flashing and discoloration from the flames, oxidation and reduction atmosphere that they create.
But what if you were to create a grating which would allow the fumes to go up and blow that and had a forced draft with a secondary exit for your hot air? Could you get the hot air at high temperature, to your chamber, your firing chamber?
Well, the hot air from the coals is going into the chamber as well. But you're trying to talk about separating the
trying to create a clean, hot air. Mm-hmm. I suppose
that's a possibility. I'll make a point about that. In clean burning, once the chimney gets to about 2,000 degrees, it's very clean burning. There's almost no smoke. In my kilns, my particular experiences is you can burn it with no visible smoke at all. You just never even know there's like a fireplace in the house, very, very little smoke coming out of them. Here's a few construction slides of a kiln I built in Orlando. And I'll just kind of run through this series. I built up a platform to raise the chamber up on a cement block. And here's kind of a view. The flues that go in and out of the kiln are very important. The openings where the flames enter and exit are, those need to be calculated. The dimensions of the chimney compared to the dimensions of the chamber are important. There's ratios that you should calculate all the dimensions. And here we have kind of a view of, there are those white shapes are the kiln shells. So I kind of set those in to get an idea of how they were going to fit within the chamber. And there's kind of three bricks kind of in the middle, which is the bag wall, the flames entering. Actually, if you can imagine, it's the flames would enter in the holes in the bottom and splash into that, those three bricks that would divert the flame upward, and then they would exit out those two smaller holes above the white shells, the kiln shells, and then the chimney is beyond that.
Are those all hard brick?
These are all hard fire brick. Here's kind of a better side view of the fireboxes on the left-hand side. You can maybe detect some little grate bars. Those are bricks, so the air comes from beneath and up through the chamber and out the chimney. So it's kind of an in-process construction. It's all made out of fire bricks. This kiln weighs about 10 tons. Very heavy structure. Each brick, clay fire brick, and they weigh about 8 pounds a piece. They're very heavy, kind of expensive. Maybe now they're $1.50 a brick. There are other kinds of better insulating materials, but the wood ash will, which creates glaze on pots, will also create glaze on the bricks and melt the bricks. So you have to use a refractory hard brick that resists the fluxing action of the wood ash. Here's another quick shot. Putting some steel framework on there to hold that arch. All that steel is just to hold that arch up. That arch, which weighs about a ton. Here it is firing all by itself, and this is right along in the firing, and you can see this is, it's not as dramatic as some of those fire kilns I showed earlier. It's actually very quiet, and many times I've been firing a kiln and people walk up and they have no idea what's going on. They don't realize that there's a firing point going on at all. Here's a favorite firing, a memorable firing of mine. Marty is firing this kiln where during Hurricane Elena, and the chimney is going back and forth, and the rain is coming straight in. And earlier in the night, I had been firing all through the night, and the officer came by and told me I had to leave because there was a hurricane coming. And I said, there's no way I can leave in the middle of this firing. And I said, well, suit yourself. And so we continued and finished it totally soaked. The wood was wet. We were desperate, but we did reach temperature in spite of it. One thing that's important is using dry wood. That half of the fuel can be consumed just drying moisture from the wood, so that's important. And here, the chimney in this case is made out of clay tile, flue tile bricks that would be used in house construction for a fireplace. That economizes on some of the materials.
Did you tend through that small hole that we can see?
Is
that
that's the stoke hole, the one on the left can in the firebox area. All the wood passes through that hole, circulates through the chamber.
And then where whoever is standing there underneath is where the air would come in?
Yeah, I guess I should back up here.
Where Marty is standing.
Kind of in the lower left-hand corner are some small little holes, and those are what you use to regulate where the air goes in, and you plug
so
up some.
So you plug up some and feed it differently.
Yeah. By opening the bottom ones, you can get a longer flame, and by opening the top ones and closing the bottoms, you can get a shorter flame, so you can adjust and regulate the flame, and therefore you can, if you have a cold spot or a hot spot, you can tend to.
Do you have to brick in your, did you brick in your door then? Is that what?
Yeah, every time
you re-bricked.
Because of the inside of the kiln starts to get glazed up, if you had a swinging hinge door, it would seal itself up and you wouldn't be able to open the kiln. Mm-hmm. So each time you have to take the bricks away and kind of chip them away and open the door.
Do you have any examples of what your wood looks like? Because it must be small pieces then to get through that.
2x4s would be about as big as you want. You're splitting that down. Other kinds of kilns use, the bigger the piece of wood, you just go slower. And that's okay. It's less work. It just slows your firing time down. If you can find a wood source that a lot of cabinet shops or places are throwing out scrap wood that's really not good for much, it's not even good. A lot of people don't like to burn small wood in their fireplace because it's more work, it burns too quickly. But that kind of wood is ideal for wood firing. In a few slides here, this is the University of Florida, where I'm at now. This is the bottom floor of this building is a ceramics studio. We got about 11,000 square feet of studio space. These two front buildings here are the kiln rooms. And maybe you can see on the far right hand, is left hand, is where the wood kiln is at. And this is the one, first one I built there. And you can see it's pretty clean. I put a white wash on it. It looks pretty snappy with that white on there. And I'm right in the midst of the university, and the fact that I've been able to get away with it with no complaints for 40 firings now, we fire pretty frequently. It's an indication that I'm able to fire a clean burning without being an eyesore or a nuisance. I don't have these billet, a lot of smoke coming out. In fact, the chimney comes right out into these offices. They kind of look out at the chimney. Anyway,
10 hours, is that true?
Yeah, about 10, 12, or 12 hours. This might give an indication, I don't know if you can make this out, but first off, the way it might be stacked, if you're not familiar with how you would load a kiln, these are sloping carbide shields stacked, and so the wear is very efficiently placed in. You kind of group heights together, grouping similar shapes together. The flames are going to filter through this all the wear in various areas. And at the top, on the top shelf, there are
three little red shapes up there. There are actually some other white shapes behind those. And you leave a little hole in the doorway and you look and view in there, and those little cones are designed to melt at different varying temperatures. In fact, there are 60 different cones that melt at different temperatures. They all have a number on them and correspond to a specific temperature. And so when they bend over, then you know that it is at that temperature.
I don't know that you suspend it. You just know that you...
You just need to reach it and that's it.
And that's it. Okay. So you don't have to hold that temperature.
No, once you reach it, there's been enough time through the whole firing that everything is melted. And this one beside that, when I built this one, this is just kind of in construction. It just about completed it now. It's ready to be fired. This is a real long sort of... It's about 12 feet long. It's kind of a tunnel shape kiln.
Is that going to be wood fired?
Yeah, that's a wood fired kiln as well. A few contemporary potters working in wood and contemporary kind of, this is just supposed to be art, I guess, abstract art, and showing the material. Clay, what clay could do, and the spontaneity that clay has. So I'm going to run through a series of just showing some contemporary clay pots or wood-fired pots. And the trend is a lot of very famous American potters just in the past few years have begun firing with wood. This is a Robert Turner. This is Chuck Conin, somebody I studied with. These are mostly unglazed, decorated because of the wood fire. Chuck Hines piece. And these, this one kind of resembles some of those earlier tonneau pots that I was showing. This is Peter Volkus. He's a very famous, important American, contemporary American potter. And although this might not look like much, he can command about $8,000 to $10,000 for this platter. Easily. Very flexible. It's a very large vase. It's probably about 4 feet tall. Easily $10,000. Probably more. This is all unglazed, but the wood firing is then decorated.
Who buys this?
Art collectors. Very, very good investments.
These aren't functional. I take it. They're just part
of it. These are about, this is a base that's about bases. It's probably functions as a sculpture more than anything. You know, the way a sculpture functions as an object. These are huge. This is again about 4 feet tall. He was one of the first contemporary potters to poke and tear and manipulate the clay. Because up until his time, everybody has this perfect symmetry and shiny glazes, and it had to be functional. And so he broke away from tradition. Another very simple platter. And the subtleties of wood firing can create some very beautiful effects. This is David Shaner, sort of a like a bird's nest kind of things or rocks. All these colors are coming from the wood firing. Beautiful. So this is more of a Sung Dynasty influence, an Oriental influence on this jar.
Do you get different colors? Because
they didn't kind of work. Yeah, that's a good point I meant to make earlier, that for one thing, all plant life contains salt. And so if you burn any kind of plant life, you're going to get a residue on the pieces that could form glass if it got hot enough. Different kinds of wood grown in different locations might have different mineral contents, or some woods are higher in silica than other woods. Some are have other minerals. Iron oxide or different contents, different minerals such as silica, alumina, iron, lithium, potassium, calcium, a variety of different minerals that are present in wood that all form glass or glazes.
Does the thickness of the piece make a difference? Or?
Not so much, not really. The coarseness of the clay or the temperature of the clay would mature and vitrify would make a difference. There's kind of a pot as a vessel, so it looks like a little house with windows.
How big was that?
That one, that last one?
Yeah.
This is by David Shaner. It's what he made in his house, and I would guess it's about 20 inches tall. It's
in his dining room or living room.
How much is a brain?
It's very heavy. I backed up.
It looks solid.
It does, almost looks solid. Which is beautiful. The clay can be a very heavy material, almost like cast bronze or metal. I'm confused about cast aluminum. People kind of give this cast heavy metal look and they cast it in aluminum and it's very lightweight. I'm kind of surprised by it.
Is that a clay mural up above?
No, I believe it's an oil painting.
Can you, by firing like pine versus firs, you know that you're going to get certain colors or not?
Yeah, I guess that, I don't know the difference between pine and fir, but both of them are high silica and they will probably give you a shiny greenish color. Or if you burn with oak, it tend to get a rough reddish color.
Okay.
I burn with all scrap wood and it's difficult for me to. To say one wood burns special effect, another one. I know that oak and pine are different, but I burn quite a mixture of different woods in any one given fire, so I get a lot of different results.
Can you introduce other chemicals to it at the top end and affect the color?
I'm sure you could. That's something I've only introduced, like salt and zircopax and zirconium and copper and stuff.
Sure.
And there are a lot of fuming agents, but if you start doing that, you might destroy your kiln and shorten the life of your kiln and shells and glaze up everything and be one solid mass of glass.
Salt will run out to about a 50-gallon drum.
Yeah, you could. I think you could probably introduce feldspar or feldspathic rock as a dust.
Tailings,
maybe. I don't know, maybe. This is an important famous potter, Daniel Rhodes, too. So I'm trying to give you an indication a lot of, this is a, not a very good slide, Tom Coleman, who was from Portland, Oregon. Okay. I'm going to rush through some of these. This is Jack Troy. And some of these are very beautiful, subtle things that you kind of have to get to know and you have to read them and get familiar with what they are and why they are. I think it's very important that in this high technology day and age, our modern age, it's kind of a unique thing or quite an interesting phenomenon that these fires are reverting back to wood firing techniques. And here's a picture of interior of Jack Troy's kiln. You can kind of see how it's kind of a curved, like the inside of a great whale or something. He's at the bottom of the fire mouth, and we're at the top end where the chimney is. Got just a few more slides. What?
You mentioned about how you can't believe
there's a fire. Oh, yeah. Another Jack Troy piece. So wood firing tends to promote this kind of organic, natural look that you get because you get involved with the whole process. It's you're in control of the firing. You can't walk away from the firing. You are at one with the fire. Each piece of wood, you're feeding the kiln. Other kinds of kilns, electric kiln, you just turn the dial, or a gas kiln, you just turn the bell. But a wood kiln, you're totally in control. You're the one that's supplying the fuel. You can't walk away. If I'm firing by myself, I can't even go and get a drink or go to the bathroom, because in 2 or 3 minutes' time, you can drop. Because there's such a strong draw of draft going through there. In 2 or 3 minutes' time, you could lose an hour's worth of firing time.
And if you lost heat that fast, would you get parking?
And sometimes the parts of the one you could probably, if you're not constantly climbing in temperature, you can, and you suddenly drop and chill the pots, you can crack them. That's a danger or a hazard. I'm just going to try to go through some of these. These are all unglazed and they're just decorated from the fire. And you get this sort of dramatic kind of a story of how the flames were rushing around these pieces.
Have you done any of these, Jeremy? Are these any of yours?
I got a couple coming up that are mine, I guess. Here you can see the flames coming from one side. And it's just, there were some little wads of clay that kind of protected these white spots where the flame was shielded from the piece. And so you just get this kind of almost an erosion or
pieces of, pieces were on there apparently were, as they were, they burned off, they were giving off gases, I suppose.
Oh, possibly, the clay does give off, if it's raw clay, it would give off some gas, but most of this is, the flame's coming from one side, so it deposits ash in different ways. There are light waves can, at different temperatures, the light waves can affect the color of the clay, and then there's oxidation and reduction that occurs too. That different oxides will change their color and reduction. Paul Shalo. So these pots are contemporary pots that look very much like old pots, Ken Ferguson. And then by working with wood in this kind of crude fashion, it tends to bring out a gestural quality in the way you work. I recommend it for my students that wood carving causes you to see things you wouldn't maybe otherwise have seen in your work. That you might, it might accentuate a finger mark or a thumbprint or the way the shoulder is, the angle of the shoulder. No, this is a friend of mine's.
But is there any glaze on the inside of that one?
Yeah, you can glaze the inside because they're protected like this with these lids, and the wood ash doesn't get inside. So usually you put a liner or something that glaze on the inside. In Japan, a pot like this would probably sell for several $1,000s, contemporary work. And that's something American aesthetics doesn't seem to, or hasn't, begun to appreciate these wood-fired pots. This is one of mine, and I started using wood in the early, mid-70s when the oil crisis was on, and I thought that by now, I thought there was no future. I could never afford to fire with gas or electricity, that I had to find an alternative fuel. So I got interested in wood as an alternative fuel, not as a flashing kind of this wood ash collection and stuff. So I was firing celadon and glazed ware and wood burning kilns, and you don't really see any effects of the wood ash. Maybe more current piece that it's more of a crude or gestural piece. This is mine. Fast fire, I'm not getting this ash real up so much as I am flashing. Pots, and I made this mention earlier that pots throughout history have been fired with wood. Here's a beautiful glazed subdynasty tea bowl, and the only indication you can see on the foot is kind of flash and kind of a toasty color. That's the raw clay and color from the wood ash or the wood firing, but the glazed surface is beautiful, pure, even though it's been fired with wood. And the wood can enhance many glazes and make them even better. This was Sun Dynasty, so it was obviously wood fired, and there's a, you know, quite a different, you don't have that buildup of ash. Early American crocks and jugs were wood fired. Here you can detect just a little flashing at the foot or the base of this piece. There's a little kind of toasty little marker on the foot. And even the Italian Renaissance Maiolica ware was definitely fired in wood burning kilns, but there's obviously no wood ash on this piece either. So wood has been used for a fuel for a long, long time in many, a variety of ways, and you don't always have to get that wood ash buildup, but it is a common or increasingly or a trend in American ceramics right now, an increasing trend of getting that ash, and potters seem to be really interested in that. And I've got one short story. So in May, I was in Canada. I built a wood burning kiln for these people. We built it in fire in a week's time, and so here's just a series again of kiln constructions. I first built this pad, and that's just to elevate the chamber, and maybe here there would be a hill and you could elevate it by just building the chamber up on the side of a hill. Put some aluminum foil, and then there's a layer of fire brick. And here we're looking at the chamber, and kind of laid out the chamber size and the
what's chamber. The aluminum foil for?
That just kind of helps keep the air from coming up through, seeping up through the floor, and the bottom layer of aluminum foil will pretty much remain intact. And you want to try to prevent all that seepage of cold air through the bottom of the floor. They're kind of laid out. There's the doorway kind of in the middle is what will become the doorway, and then on the right-hand side is the entry flue. And building up the walls, you can see that we built an arch form that's going to be put up there. And I mostly built barrel arch
shaped. It's kind of a little bit different than most kilns. They have sprung arches or capped arches. They can put a full rounded barrel arch. It becomes a beautiful shape, and the flames can easily turn on that curved ceiling and come back down. Building up with bricks, and of course, there's a lot of welding involved, and we got a chop saw to cut the steel and fabricate all the frame of the steel work that has to go around. So I've learned to kind of be a handyman because of this kiln building. Cut and weld steel on top of the chimney. This kiln ended up weighing about 9 or 10 tons. I don't know exactly, but it's a pretty heavy little structure. It's not something that's going to fall over easily. Got 9-inch walls everywhere. And we last then coated the whole thing with that clay, kind of clay and cement and sand mortar that would help better seal up the kiln so the air wouldn't seep through the bricks. You don't want any air seeping through the bricks. You want all of your air to come through the firebox, up through the grates, and through the wood. And here's kind of the chimney. Actually, the fire has already commenced, and we're still working on the kiln, trying to get it finished up. And here it was in the seventh day, after it was cooling down. And you can kind of see in the front here, the firebox with the little bricks would be open and closed to regulate the flame. So this is the kind of kiln that I've been mostly experimenting with. It's a very efficient kiln, fast firing, relatively fast firing. It could be fired in 10 or 12 hours on 10.
So a nice size. Did you test it out then before you left?
Yeah, this, we did fire it once before I left.
But we didn't see the pieces.
I looked through with a flashlight, but I didn't see any of the pieces.